From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
We're not out here vigilanting anybody. We're out here just protecting the border.
Some call them vigilantes. They call themselves Minutemen. They're staked out along the Arizona-Mexico border to track down undocumented immigrants. We'll host a debate. But first, we take a look at the rising cost of oil.
Oil prices are high, and they're likely to go even higher. And the reason is quite simple. There's a limited amount of this stuff in the world, and it looks like we're running out.
And we remember Japanese-American civil rights pioneer Fred Korematsu. The U.S. jailed him during World War II for refusing to be sent to an internment camp.
In those days, if you're an Asian, people automatically think you don't belong in this country. You're not an American. And I thought that was wrong.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Rome, tens of thousands of people are lining up to see the body of Pope John Paul II lying in state at the Vatican. By Friday, Rome expects more than 2 million pilgrims to come to the city for the Pope's funeral. 200 heads of state, including President Bush, will attend Friday's funeral in what the BBC reports will be one of the largest gatherings of world leaders in history. Meanwhile, the Church's cardinals have begun making preparations for the conclave during which they'll elect Pope John Paul's successor. On Monday, South African Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu called on the Church to pick an African pope. The Church hasn't had a pope from Africa in 15 centuries. Nigerian Cardinal Francis Arinze is seen as one possible candidate to become pope. Back in the United States, in response to fierce criticism of the USA Patriot Act, the Washington Post reports Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez plans to propose today making minor modifications to the act. The move will mark the first effort by the Justice Department to address concerns of critics. Gonzalez is expected to announce his support for limiting the use of secret warrants strictly for cases involving national security and to allow the targets to mount legal challenges to the search. Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller are appearing today to defend the Patriot Act during Senate hearings and whether certain provisions of the act should be renewed at the end of the year. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Larry Craig of Idaho and Democrat Richard Durbin of Illinois plan to introduce joint legislation today aimed at scaling back major parts of the law. Over the past 3 years, hundreds of local and state governments have passed resolutions criticizing the USA Patriot Act. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has pledged to move forward with plans to build 3,500 new homes in the West Bank. The construction is considered illegal under international law, and the Bush administration has said the plan is, quote, at odds with U.S. policy. Sharon also wants to form a corridor between the city of Jerusalem and Maal Edumim, the largest West Bank settlement. Palestinians have protested the planned construction because it'll split East Jerusalem in two, effectively preventing it from becoming the capital of a future Palestinian state. Sharon is expected to meet with President Bush on Monday in Crawford, Texas. Meanwhile, Israel plans to start dumping 10,000 pounds of garbage a month inside the West Bank. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports the project was launched despite international treaties prohibiting an occupying state from making use of occupied territory unless it benefits the local population. Palestinians fear the garbage dump will jeopardize water sources in the West Bank. In Iraq, gunmen have kidnapped an Iraqi general who commands a special armored unit. Brigadier General Mohammad Jalal Saleh was kidnapped while driving in Baghdad earlier today. Meanwhile, the Telegraph of London reports the British government plans to cut in half the number of troops it has in Iraq over the next year. The phased withdrawal calls for the British troop level to decrease from 9,000 to 3,500. At the same time, Britain plans to send more troops to Afghanistan to aid in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. In other Iraq news, the Pentagon's revealed it has been detaining a U.S. citizen without charges in Iraq since last year. The Jordanian-born man is a naturalized U.S. citizen. His name has not been released. The U.S. has accused him of being a top aide to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. In Saudi Arabia, security forces killed 9 militants over the past 3 days, including 2 people the government has identified as Saudi leaders of al-Qaeda. More than 50 Saudi officers have been injured in the fighting. The killings mark the bloodiest incident between the Saudi state and militants in the past 2 years. Civil rights activists in Georgia are calling on law enforcement agencies to reopen the investigation into a lynching that took place on July 25, 1946, in Monroe, Georgia. On that day, a white mob of more than 50 men murdered 4 young African-American sharecroppers. The 4 were driving near the Apalachee River, where they were stopped by the mob, pulled out of their car, dragged down a wagon trail, and then fatally shot. On Saturday, state lawmaker Tyrone Brooks led a march to publicize the case. Brooks says, quote, "This was the most heinous collective crime ever perpetuated against African Americans in this state." A new Amnesty International report has found executions around the world are nearing record levels. Last year, at least 3,800 people were executed. 97% of the executions were carried out in 4 countries: China, Iran, Vietnam, and the United States. China carried out the vast majority of the executions. Meanwhile, a total of 120 countries have now abolished the death penalty in law or practice. In business news, the country's second largest oil company, Chevron Texaco, has announced its plans to buy Unocal in a deal that is valued at $18 billion. Newly released emails show government scientists working on the proposed nuclear waste dump site at Yucca Mountain in Nevada knowingly fabricated records in order to help the project move forward. In one email, a scientist admitted, quote, "I've made up the dates and names. I'll be happy to make up more stuff." In another message, the scientist wrote, quote, "In the end, I keep track of 2 sets of files, the ones that'll keep QA happy and the ones that were actually used." QA apparently refers to quality assurance. The emails were written in 1999 and 2000 during the Clinton administration. Yucca Mountain is the proposed site of an underground repository to hold some 77,000 tons of nuclear waste and used reactor fuel from commercial nuclear power plants. The project has been met by widespread fears that the plan to bury the nuclear waste is too risky. The Department of Homeland Security has launched the country's largest mock terror drill ever on Monday. The drill began with a mock biological attack at Keene University in New Jersey and a simulated chemical weapons explosion in New London, Connecticut. 10,000 people will participate in the mock attacks. And on Capitol Hill, Republican Senator John Cornyn yesterday suggested the recent surge in courtroom violence may be a result of judges being, quote, unaccountable to the public. Senator Cornyn said, quote, "I wonder whether there may be some connection between the perception where judges are making political decisions yet are unaccountable to the public, that it builds up and builds up and builds up to the point where some people engage in violence." And in Washington, President Bush has nominated Vice President Cheney's son-in-law to become the general counsel of the Department of Homeland Security. Philip Perry is married to Cheney's daughter, Elizabeth Cheney Perry.
On the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan.
Price of Oil by Billy Bragg here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When you ask most people in the world why the U.S. invaded Iraq, the majority would probably include oil in their answer. But now, 2 years after the invasion, oil prices have not only not gone down for U.S. consumers, they've actually gone up, and in dramatic form. Oil prices have risen almost $15 a barrel since the year began, and gas is costing U.S. motorists an average of $2.15 a gallon. Yesterday, oil prices briefly topped $58 a barrel, causing some shockwaves on the markets. The Bush administration is fond of blaming oil prices on OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. But OPEC officials say the pricing is beyond their control. So what's driving this so-called crisis? To discuss this, we're joined by two guests in our studio. Jim Paul is here. He's the executive director of Global Policy Forum. He's based at the United Nations and monitors events there. He's authored a number of reports on oil companies in Iraq. They can be found at www.globalpolicy.org. On the line with us from Massachusetts, Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. His latest book is called Blood and Oil. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jim Paul, let's begin with you. What's going on? Why are these prices soaring?
Well, Amy, there's two different elements to this. One is the temporary conjuncture in the oil markets, which include things like refinery fire in the United States and other factors like that. The situation in Iraq is also an element of that type. But more fundamentally, the markets are moving higher and higher because it looks like the world is actually running out of oil. There's been a big dispute about this in the oil industry for a long time, but the Unocal takeover is one example of this. The oil companies can't find more oil, and so they're buying other companies in order to increase their reserves. This is, I think, the most explosive aspect to this issue.
Professor Michael Clare, do you agree?
Yes, I generally agree. I think we have to even elaborate on what Jim Paul said. We're facing a structural change in the oil and energy industry that's likely to be permanent. And that structural change is that the output cannot keep up with demand. And what you have to add to the equation is surging demand for oil around the world, especially in the United States and China and Japan, Europe, and India, and the global oil industry is simply not capable of satisfying this rising level of demand and won't be, so far as we could tell, for the rest of the petroleum era. So there's going to be intense competition. And then you add on top of that political instability in Venezuela and Nigeria and Angola and Saudi Arabia and Iraq, and you could understand why prices are so high.
Did the invasion of Iraq have any effect?
Certainly it has, because the invasion of Iraq, which was supposed to produce greater stability in the Persian Gulf and therefore facilitate higher levels of output, has had the opposite effect. It has promoted instability in the region. It's invited a massive insurgency which regularly attacks oil facilities and pipelines, and it's led to terrorism and instability in Saudi Arabia and other countries in the region. So there's no greater stability, and when things become tormented like this, oil deliveries drop.
There's a lot of blaming of OPEC. Is OPEC in control of this, Jim Paul?
I don't think OPEC is in control of it. These are, as Mike was just saying, these are forces that are much bigger than OPEC. OPEC's own production is pretty high in terms of its capacity right now. Only Saudi Arabia has a very, very small amount of swing production left. And so I don't think we can blame it on OPEC at all.
Mm-hmm. So what's going to happen right now, Michael Clare, around this issue?
You're going to see oil and energy become the central political issue of the coming future. I sense as I travel around the country that people in the United States are becoming much more aware of the issue of peak oil that Jim alluded to before, the notion that we're reaching the moment when global oil output will reach its peak or maximum level and then drop. And making oil less and less available, more competition, more stress. people are beginning to understand that this will affect everything in America because we're so dependent on oil that it's going to challenge our way of life. And I think people are beginning to understand this.
Jim Paul, does global warming play a role?
Yes, it certainly does. It's well understood that the carbon emissions that result from burning this stuff are causing global warming, or a main cause of it. And so it's very likely that as understanding of this increases and political momentum develops for regulating it, there are going to be regulatory rules that are going to cut down on the possibility of producing and burning petroleum. And this is one of the many factors that has the markets worried and the companies themselves, even though they're making record profits right now.
What about Venezuela, Michael Clare? You mentioned it, one of the major oil suppliers in the world. What role does oil play in the U.S.? Well, many have said trying to topple the president, Hugo Chavez.
Well, this is part of, Amy, this is part of a global struggle. The United States, under the Bush-Cheney administration, is committed to perpetuating our dependence on oil. And the only way we could do that is by procuring more and more of the rest of the world's oil. I mean, everywhere, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, Central Asia, we need more and more of all of those places' oil. And anytime somebody stands in the way of that, like Hugo Chavez, and says, wait a minute, we want to control our own oil destiny, we want to produce it at a rate that's good for our economy, and in fact we want to use our oil to boost regional Latin American development rather than satisfy American consumers, this is a direct assault on the oil-driven foreign policy of the Bush administration. So it's hardly surprising, I think, that the administration is seeking to undermine Hugo Chavez, and I'm sure they're working on that night and day.
Talking about other conflict areas, Jim Paul, what about Sudan?
Well, Sudan is a place where U.S. and China have more or less come head-to-head. It's one of quite a few countries where that's been happening. The Chinese have an enormous interest in developing their external oil resources because they need to import maybe as many as 5 million barrels a day from the Middle East area. And they started developing oil in Sudan, and the U.S. and the U.K. companies didn't like that. They were shut out, so we have a very, very tough and very nasty and virtually genocidal conflict going on in Sudan. And I think quite a bit of it can be traced to the conflicts of oil interest there.
Michael Clare, what about the Senate voting to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
This, I think, is a form of delusion. It is smoke and mirrors to distract the American public from the reality of the Bush plan. I think Americans understand that our dependence on imported oil is a threat to our well-being. I think that's well understood. So Bush says, I have a solution to that. We'll drill in Anwar and become independent. Well, he's lying, because there's no way that Anwar, even if it has all the oil they claim it does, is going to diminish our dependence on imported oil one bit. We will continue to be ever more dependent on imported oil. But it's a way of distracting the public from the reality of our predicament.
What, Michael Clare, are the alternatives?
The alternatives are to reduce our dependence on petroleum, period. There's no way you could separate our dependence on foreign petroleum from our dependence on petroleum in general. We simply have to find ways to reduce our consumption, and that means primarily in transportation, because that's where we use most of our oil. It means driving fewer miles or driving more fuel-efficient vehicles like hybrids or very fuel-efficient diesels. There isn't any other solution. Oh, and public transit, of course.
In a piece you did for the Los Angeles Times on Sunday called Arctic Drilling is No Energy Answer, you mention the Cheney report, the whole report on energy policy, which we haven't heard very much about lately, the litigation over it, the demand that he reveal who it was he consulted with. But what ultimately came of that? Is it a push for dependence on oil or not?
Absolutely. This is a blueprint for the preservation of the existing energy paradigm in the United States, which is big oil, big coal, nuclear power, automobiles, and highways. That's our existing energy paradigm. And the Bush plan is 100% committed to preserving that for another 20 years or so. And the only way they could do that is to increase America's procurement of foreign oil. So what the Bush Energy Plan really is a blueprint to go after the oil of Colombia, Venezuela, Angola, Nigeria, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. That's the essence of the strategy. And I think the war in Iraq, which followed that, was partly shaped by that blueprint.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Michael Clare, professor at Hampshire College, author of the book Blood and Oil, and Jim Paul in our studio, executive director of Global Policy Forum. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll debate the Minutemen on the border. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In Arizona, a group calling itself the Minuteman Project has stationed scores of men and women along the Mexican border in a controversial effort to track down undocumented immigrants. The Minutemen take their name from a militia group during the American Revolutionary War. The group's founder, James Gilchrist, says the project has attracted some 450 volunteers from around the country. On Monday, Gilchrist said they aided in the arrest of 146 undocumented immigrants. The Minutemen have staked out across a 23-mile stretch of border northeast of Nogales for the month-long action. Many use binoculars and night vision goggles. Some are armed with guns. Over 20 pilots with aircraft are also surveying the area. Organizers call their effort a peaceful protest over the government's failure to secure its borders. Both the Mexican government and the Bush administration have described the Minutemen as vigilantes. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union has sent observers to keep tabs on the Minutemen to ensure they don't take the law into their own hands. Today, we host a debate. Joining us on the line from Arizona is the Minuteman Project's media liaison, Mike McGarry, and Jennifer Allen is with us, the executive director of the Border Action Network. Why don't we begin with Mike McGarry of the Minutemen? Tell us why so many people have gone to the border. What are you doing there?
Well, first of all, the reason is it should be obvious. I mean, if you believe Time Magazine's report last October, we have something in the neighborhood of 3 million people from all over the world breaking into the country, and we have an out-of-control, what could by any definition, be termed an invasion. So the Minuteman Project is, I mean, this show is called Democracy Now! This could not be a more democratically inspired project. It is people from all over the country, United States citizens, naturalized citizens, and illegal immigrants who have assembled here to peaceably assemble to petition the government for a redress of their grievances. The principal grievance here is that the Congress and the President will not adequately enforce the border. Poll after poll shows that 75% to 80% of Americans want this done, and they want it done now. And so that's the essence of this effort.
Jennifer Allen of Border Action Network, what's your response?
Well, what we've been seeing over the last 2 years is that Arizona is become the hotbed, sort of the staging ground for a larger anti-immigrant movement that is playing on the fact that immigration routes have been concentrated in Arizona. This is a direct byproduct of U.S. Border Patrol's strategy to first hit California and Texas with walls, lights, surveillance equipment, thousands of Border Patrol agents. So, yeah, of course, immigration routes are going to be concentrated and funneled through Arizona. But what we don't need is civilians taking arms up and out patrolling the desert for immigrants themselves. No additional amount of men with guns is ever going to solve the problems of failing immigration and border policy. What we need to see is comprehensive immigration reform, not vigilantes.
Mike McGarry, your response.
Well, I have a lot to say about that. I'll try to keep it concise. Let's get our terms straight. An immigrant is an invited guest into the American home. An illegal alien is someone who kicked in the back door and commits multiple misdemeanors and felonies to entrench himself here. Any suggestion that this is anti-immigrant is pejorative. We have immigrants, legal immigrants here. Unless you, as part of this project, unless you think they are calling themselves anti-immigrant, that would be a bit of a contradiction. This is the kind of stuff we run into all the time. Our opposition tries to characterize this movement, and it's a grassroots movement, as being anti-immigrant. That's just a pejorative. They know what they're doing. They play this game all the time, and we reject that.
Jennifer Allen.
Well, we need to be clear about two things, about who the players are. The reality is that immigrants that are coming across the border are coming here to either join their families or they're coming here to fill some jobs or to just improve their quality of life. The only folks that we're seeing committing criminal acts are the vigilantes that are out patrolling the border. We have 4 civil lawsuits right now that are pending other vigilante activities that have been, because the Minuteman Project is not the first time that we've had people out patrolling, looking for immigrants, detaining them at gunpoint. And what we have seen, too, is that what happens is that folks pull out their gun. Folks are getting shot at. Folks have been kicked. Folks have been dragged around. Folks have been yelled at. Folks have been bitten by dogs, thrown on the front of ATVs, and dragged through the desert scrub. We want to talk about criminal activities. That's first and foremost.
Jennifer Allen, you say that this is a logical extension of the policy around immigration, yet the Bush administration has condemned the Minutemen.
Interestingly, yeah. What we have seen, too, is that as immigration routes and as immigration enforcement and border strategies have built up in California and Texas, the routes have been concentrated. Everybody comes to the area then where there is less enforcement, and so people have been concentrating in the Arizona region. We're really happy that the Bush administration has come out and labeling this project as vigilantism and condemned it. It's the first time that the White House administration and President Fox as well out of Mexico have directly condemned this type of activity.
Mike McGarry, your response to the Bush administration saying you're vigilantes, what do you think of President Bush?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, this is all part of the attempt to castigate this movement. I mean, the Bush immigration policies are failures and just nonsense. And he apparently would rather satisfy the whim of the president of Mexico, who apparently encouraged him to use this pejorative. We reject that. I mean, we are being vigilant, of course, but anything but vigilantes is nonsense. And I just caution your listeners to listen how the language is manipulative. I I mean, it's treated as a foregone conclusion that this is anti-immigrant, that this is vigilante. So just kind of use those terms matter-of-factly. And when I just heard Jennifer say, talk about filing lawsuits, we expect all this kind of stuff. This is the kind of stuff the open borders lobby, this kind of hyperbole that so characterizes everything they do, and it's all a bunch of dopey nonsense.
Mike McGarry, let me ask you again. Mike McGarry, media liaison for the Minuteman Project. Jennifer Allen with us of Border Action Network. But Border Patrol officials are saying that the Minutemen have been peaceful, but have still been disrupting U.S. Border Patrol operations by unwittingly tripping sensors that alert agents to possible intruders. Agents have to respond to the false alarms, which pulls them off their normal patrols, so that you're defeating your own purpose.
Sure. Well, let me just make two observations about that. Number one is that, this is like two college roommates moving into their room the first couple of days. You sort of have to decide where each other's stuff is in the refrigerator. And sort of respect that. But the second thing is, if you had been out here, you would have seen, because this is an international media event. Press is from all over this country and all over the world is here in droves. And as a press member yourself, you probably experience how those are real feeding frenzies. And there are a lot of these press people sort of willy-nilly tramping around the desert and trying to get their stories and their angles and their scoops. And we attribute at least most of this kind of stuff to them, but it's a realistic concern and it's something that has to be adjusted to, and everybody's mindful of that. And this is about cooperating, not impeding. So just a day or two of getting used to each other.
Jennifer Allen, what do you think is the solution?
Well, interestingly, what the Minutemen Project is asking for, they've already got. They have been calling for more militarization of the border, when in fact the manpower, the number of agents on the U.S.-Mexico Border Patrol has tripled within the last 10 years. The Bush administration just put out a proposal to increase the technology budget by $2.5 billion over the next 5 years. In 2004, with the passage of the 9/11 Commission's recommendations, it was just approved to double the size of the U.S. Border Patrol. We already have massive border militarization. And so, in fact, no amount of additional enforcement or no amount of men with guns, whether they're vigilantes, Border Patrol, or U.S. military troops, is ever going to solve the complex problems that have compelled people to make the difficult decision to leave their families, to leave their hometowns behind them. What, in fact, we really need to see is comprehensive immigration reform, policies that acknowledge and recognize the economic and political realities of this country and of immigration and of immigrants themselves. What we also need to see on a more smaller and immediate sense is that the local officials from the Cochise County Attorney, the county in southern Arizona where most of these vigilante activities are happening, up to the Arizona Attorney General and the Arizona U.S. Attorney, need to step up, do their job, and prosecute these vigilante groups for their criminal activities, which is the everyday activities of rounding people up, detaining them illegally, impersonating law enforcement, organizing militias. These are all crimes at both the state and federal level. And the fact that these officials have done nothing in spite of massive community mobilizations over the last 2 years has created this climate of impunity where, Mr. Gilchrist and other people from around the country think that they can just come into southern Arizona and do what they want.
Mike McGarry, that charge.
Wow, there's a lot there. And Jennifer, I'm sorry, whatever her name is, just made up a whole bunch of stuff about detaining. This is a civilian neighborhood watch gone national. There is no detaining of anybody. It's observe and report and stay the heck out of the way. So this image that she's trying to manufacture here is a chimera. The second thing is that, where are my notes? Is that, she talked about technology. Technology does not apprehend people. Any supposed technology that may come to the border is not going to be the same as manpower. The third thing, there is no militarization of the border. By definition, a militarization means the military. The military is not there. As far as the 9/11 Commission report, they strongly recommended and the Congress approved for 2,000 additional border agents that are needed. According to every grassroots border agent actually out in the field, says that they need. And what the Bush Commission did, the Bush administration did, of those 2,000 that the commission recommended be 2,000 per year for 5 years, be placed, trained and placed along the border. In President Bush's budget, he slashed for this year 1,790 agents out of that. That left 210, and that doesn't even cover the attrition rate. That is to say, people who retire, transfer out, or just get fed up.
Mike McGarry, there's an interesting piece on the front page of the New York Times today entitled "Illegal Immigrants Are Bolstering Social Security with Billions." It says, as the debate over Social Security heats up, the estimated 7 million or so illegal immigrant workers in the U.S. are now providing the system with a subsidy of as much as $7 billion a year. While it's been evident for years illegal immigrants pay a variety of taxes, the extent of their contributions to Social Security is striking, the newspaper says. It says the money added up to about 10% of last year's surplus, the difference between what the system currently receives in payroll taxes and what it doles out in pension benefits. Moreover, the money paid by illegal workers and their employers is factored into all the Social Security Administration's projections that illegal immigrants in this country are providing a subsidy of as much as $7 billion a year.
Okay, well, the New York Times misreported that. This is, by the way, a little bit beyond the scope of the Minuteman Project, but I do know a little bit about it. And let me just give you two facts. First of all, research shows that about one-half of 50% of illegal aliens pay taxes. And what that research also shows is that most of the non-assignable contributions into the Social Security Fund are not, are from other sources other than illegal immigrants. In fact, the research suggests that about a quarter of the, difficult to define contributions come from illegal aliens. So, New York Times, took a position that isn't consistent with the research as I know the research.
Jennifer Allen, we end with you of Border Action Network.
Well, clearly, I think as the New York Times article shows, as have many other reports and studies, that immigrants are the economic backbone of this country. Even just looking locally in Arizona, the Yuma Arizona Growers Association just put out about 3 weeks ago a call to the Border Patrol to back off on their checkpoints because they weren't able to get the lettuce pickers that they needed and the crops were going to suffer. Yuma provides the majority of the lettuce for the country. Similarly, in the business section, a study was done looking at the increasing retirement rates of the baby boomer population, and the predictions are that there's going to be a massive glut within the workforce, and that many employers right now are looking at ways to accommodate their hiring practices and their general practices to accommodate an aging and encourage an aging workforce, because in fact there is a big gap. Those are realities of this country. What is not a reality and what is not matching is our border enforcement strategies, which includes armed civilians taking upon themselves to go down and hunt down immigrants.
Oh, hold it. None of that is reality. You're making up a lot of stuff, lady. If we ever have a chance to debate this, where we actually have some time, I would like to do that because you got to stop this.
I can tell you what we have seen. You know, the organization is a community organization based out of Douglas and Nogales, the communities and
Nogales
that are on the ground. So what we have seen for years, you know, what you all are doing is absolutely nothing new. And
you're
what
right.
We have seen time and time again is folks that are out rounding people up at gunpoint.
There is no rounding up people at gunpoint. You're making that up. You're right. This is nothing new because my mother and father, who were born and raised in Bisbee, Arizona, told me as a child that civilian patrols along the border during World War II is a long and staid tradition. We didn't have an invasion then. We have one now. This is the most appropriate thing we can do, and it's a demonstration to the United States government, the President, the Congress, to get off their butts, stop abdicating, and do the job that they're required to do.
Mike McGarry and Jennifer Allen, I want to thank you for being with us. Mike McGarry, media liaison for Minuteman Project. Jennifer Allen, Executive Director, Border Action Network. And speaking of World War II, we go back to World War II, to the rounding up of over 120,000 Japanese Americans, and to one man Who Resisted, Fred Korematsu. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Late last week, Japanese-American civil rights pioneer Fred Korematsu died at the age of 86. He was jailed during World War II, refusing orders to be sent to an internment camp set up for U.S. residents of Japanese ancestry. Today, we take a look at his story. This is an excerpt of the documentary produced by Eric Paul Fournier. It's called Of Civil Rights and Wrongs, The Fred Korematsu Story.
We expect the worst to happen, and it did. Curfew notices were posted on the telephone poles. And then after that, about a week or so, the notice for the evacuation.
I didn't think that the government would go as far as to include American citizens to be interned without a hearing.
Fred Korematsu.
And then later on, they changed my draft card to 4C, which is enemy alien. In those days, if you're an Asian, people automatically think you don't belong in this country. You're not an American. And I thought that was wrong.
Fred Korematsu's case represented the trial that Japanese Americans never had. This was an entire population that, without evidence, without trial, without due process of any kind, were simply swept into internment camps, many losing their property, some even losing their lives.
Attorney.
The real significance of Fred's case is that it raised, for the first time, the central issue. Was the internment itself constitutional?
Peter Irons.
It was, I think, for him, a personal shock of recognition. Who am I? Am I an American? What does it mean for me to be an American?
If you look at a Fred Korematsu, you see a very ordinary man who just wanted to be left alone, but who defied the United States government because he knew it was wrong.
In 1942, an ordinary American took an extraordinary stand. Fred Korematsu boldly opposed the forced internment of Japanese Americans during World War II.
President
After
Clinton.
Being convicted for failing to report for relocation, Mr. Korematsu took his case all the way to the Supreme Court. The High Court ruled against him. But 39 years later, he had his conviction overturned in federal court, empowering tens of thousands of Japanese Americans and giving him what he said he wanted most of all, the chance to feel like an American once again.
December 7th, it was Sunday. And Sunday morning, around, gosh, it must have been about 10 o'clock, my girlfriend and I were up on Skyline Boulevard, looking down the Bay Area, the city, and so forth.
At that time, I was going around with a Caucasian girlfriend, and I liked her very much. And we had spread out the Sunday magazine, the Tribune, and just relaxed, and had the music on, car radio, Sunday, nice sunny day. And of course, we were talking mush. And all of a sudden, it stopped.
Fred Korematsu.
And they announced that Pearl Harbor was attacked. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, I thought it might be just a dream. But actually, the way they were explaining that bombs are flying here and there and people getting shot at and so forth, and I said, wow. I said, this must be really going on. There'd been so much friction between the United States and Japan. And the way Japan was so active going into China and doing all that, you know, invasion and so forth, that I had a feeling that, you know, they're just crazy enough to come down here. And that's what they did. At the nursery, my parents, they were all around the radio listening. They weren't saying very much. My mother was crying. My father was just disgusted. All that work that my parents did to that nursery and so forth, what's going to happen? A few days later, the police came down there and confiscated all the flashlights and cameras. They confiscated everything that they thought that we would use for signaling.
Professor Rita Takahashi.
The policy to incarcerate persons of Japanese ancestry has a long history. For example, the earliest immigration law of 1790 stipulated that only free whites could become naturalized citizens. There was the 1913 and 1920 alien land laws that excluded persons of Japanese ancestry from owning land, as well as the 1924 immigration law, which excluded them from further immigration.
I was a welder at Mordry Dock, a shipyard. I wanted to be in defense work, and I was doing so well that the superintendent said that he would like to advance me as foreman. And I thought that was real nice of him to do that. So Monday, when I went in to punch my time in, I find, instead of my time card, a note telling me to report to the union. Well, okay, so I went to the union. And there the agent approached me and told me, you cannot work in the shipyard. I felt that, you know, hey, I'm an American, and I'm here to help out in defense work. And I have nothing to do with Japan or any, so it's sort of an insult to me. So I went to the superintendent, and he says, I'm sorry, Fred, I can't help you. I did finally get another job, Golden Gate Ironworks in San Francisco. And that was owned by a German Jewish family. So they gave me a job on contract basis. And that's how I worked for him until Pearl Harbor.
Professor Rita Takahashi.
The bombing of Pearl Harbor and the entrance of the U.S. into the war, a lot of people saw that as a perfect opportunity to get rid of persons of Japanese ancestry. They had a stereotype of being such hard workers and that they got their children involved in all of the work and everybody in the family worked, and so therefore the cost of labor was lower and therefore they could compete better in the economic market.
Peter Irons.
There were a lot of organizations that wanted internment, the agricultural interests in California, for example, because Japanese Americans had been so successful as farmers and competitors.
So when Pearl Harbor hit, now they could say it was, quote, military necessity, and therefore they could wholesalely exclude persons of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast. There were a lot of persons, agricultural persons to media persons, who were whipping up anti-Japanese sentiments. It took a few weeks before the media started getting into gear. But the Hearst papers in Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco got started earlier.
John Frank, clerk to Associate Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black.
General DeWitt, who was a lieutenant general, is about as high as they get, was the general in charge of the West Coast. There was some feeling that the West Coast might be invaded. He had recommended that the Japanese Americans be excluded from the West Coast so that they couldn't give secret tips to the invaders if the invaders ever came. That was sheer baloney because there is no instance ever discovered in which any Japanese American on the West Coast ever did anything disloyal. It was pure foolishness.
Colonel Ben Detson, who was a government lawyer, wrote all of the arguments for the internment that General DeWitt presented to the War Department.
Peter
Ben
Irons.
Detson, who was a lawyer trained at Stanford and who should have known something about the Constitution, simply said that because Japanese Americans belong to an enemy race, their internment could be justified.
Fred Korematsu.
You see, before the war, my parents were very proud people. They always talked about Japan, you know, and also about the samurais and stuff like that. And right after Pearl Harbor, everything just, you know, they were just real quiet. They kept it to themselves. They were afraid to talk about that.
The Secret Service and the FBI had swept into the Japanese-American community and had arrested any community leader, any teacher, any civic organization head of any importance in that community.
I thought the exclusion order would be only for aliens, those that were born in Japan. I didn't think that the government would go as far as to include American citizens.
If you have the Western Defense Command, who was in charge of our movement, if they come at you with a bayonet in your back and say you're going to move into a horse stall, you do.
Fred Korematsu.
Well, I know I couldn't take my girlfriend with me, so I decided maybe we should try to sneak out to Nevada to get away from this. I told my parents that I would like to leave. Well, I didn't tell them about my girlfriend. All I said, I wanted to leave. And they were so wrapped up on what they had to do before the evacuation. And I said, Fred, you're old enough to know what to do. And so you go ahead, and if you decide you want to do that, go ahead. So I did. And then one day my girlfriend wanted to meet me. I was waiting for her at the corner and she didn't show up. I ran out of cigarettes. So like a darn fool, I went across the street to the drugstore and someone recognized me, I assumed, because when I came back and I was standing there for another 5 minutes, then the police came and they looked around and looked at me and said, "Do you see any short Japanese person around here, Asian?" I said, "No." He looked at me and says, "Well, let me see your identification." By that time, the two MPs came in the military. And he says, "We have to take you to the city hall." After I was arrested, I never did see my girlfriend again. So there must have been something going on in there, but I didn't know.
Every branch of government that is responsible for protecting the Constitution failed. I think that the congressional branch failed because Congress had no hearings on internment. Within the executive branch, the president signed this order without probably giving it more than a half an hour's thought because nobody had been responsible for presenting contrasting sides of this issue. And within the judiciary, the Supreme Court literally abandoned its role of asking probing questions.
I believe in principles. And certainly I believe that all persons without distinction are entitled to the support of the Constitution. We tried to find a legal challenge to the internment, but of course, in order to do that, you have to have a test case. You have to find somebody who is willing to have his case carried through the courts up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So we were on the lookout to find a case of that kind. It wasn't easy until I heard of Fred Korematsu's case in the newspapers. And I at once undertook to visit him at the county jail, where he was being, shall we say, detained.
But here this man was in the visitor's room in a gray suit, and a young man, and he shook my hand. He says, "I'm Ernest Bestwick. I'm an attorney, and I belong to the ACLU. I hear this fellow that I don't even know, and the blue sky come and wanted to help me."
I was there to persuade Fred, and I was hopeful that he would support a test case, that he would be willing to be the test case, the person who would challenge the government's discrimination against him. And ultimately, he did.
Attorney Ernest Bessig from the documentary of Civil Rights and Wrongs, The Fred Korematsu Story, produced by Eric Paul Fournier. Yes, Fred Korematsu died last week at the age of 86. He was jailed during World War II after he refused orders to be sent to an internment camp for U.S. residents of Japanese ancestry. After the attack at Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government ordering 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry into the camps, his attorney compared him to Rosa Parks. Korematsu challenged his arrest, and the case would eventually go to the Supreme Court. The court upheld the establishment of the internment camps, but decades later, a federal court decided to vacate Korematsu's conviction after it was uncovered the federal government had lied to the high court about the threat posed by Japanese Americans. In 1998, President Clinton awarded Korematsu a Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest honor. We're joined right now in this last minute of the program by Don Tamaki, who served on the legal team that opened the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Fred Korematsu, overturning his criminal convictions for refusing to be interned. After President Clinton awarded Mr. Korematsu the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you would think that Mr. Korematsu would have left it there. But 20 years later, in 2003, he rose again to challenge the internment of others at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. In this last few minutes, Don Tamaki, can you talk about what he did?
Well, he filed an amicus brief basically saying that what was wrong in 1942 with respect to Americans of Japanese ancestry is wrong in post-2001 with respect to American citizens, that we ought not to face jailing and incarceration without trial, without evidence, and without charges. And that was his point in filing the amicus brief. The regrettable thing is that Korematsu versus the United States, which was one of the worst U.S. Supreme Court decisions issued ever, the 1944 decision, which held upheld the constitutionality of the internment, the regrettable thing is it's more relevant today than it was, you know, years later when we reopened Fred's case.
Well, Don Tamaki, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Don Tamaki, attorney for Fred Korematsu versus the United States. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people. Mike Burke and Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Headed to Sarasota tonight. I'll be speaking at the Hyatt tomorrow night at Book Review in Huntington, Long Island. On Friday, we'll be at the University of Colorado Boulder, the Mackey Auditorium. On Saturday in Omaha in the afternoon and Lincoln, Nebraska in the evening. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.